Good morning. This is the Subcommittee on Human Services, Ways and Means. This is April 14th, day before tax day, for those who care. It's 8:30 in the morning.
Quiet.
I'm still smarting. It's the Oregon Health. I'm not smarting. I'm just smarting. I wrote the check. Oregon Health Authority, Public Health, we're doing a quick work session. I understand on a grant on something I never heard of before, syndromic surveillance grant. I did do a little reading on it, so I have a clue. That's about all. So before I open the work session, I want to give us a quick little rundown this week, and then we'll go from there.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, like the chair said, we have a grant to do a work session on, and then the state hospital will be here for the bulk of the day to do phase two, talk about some of the issues that were raised in the earlier hearing. Tomorrow we have several agencies here to talk about housing issues and how the different agencies overlap in some cases and work together. And then phase two for DHS will be on Thursday, where they start talking about their policy packages.
Thank you. So I'm going to open a work session on the federal grant application request to Oregon Health Authority, syndromic surveillance grant.
Would you please explain?
And syndromic is a phrase is used to describe how you move in interstellar space.
And we're doing this instead of transportation technology, why?
Well, that's just because there's just some bodily movements involved. Seriously, I didn't know what it was. And so luckily LFO was smart enough to tell us. This is a way of gathering data, I understand, in real time about outbreaks of issues, and it's automatically obtained from ER visits and some electronic surveillance. So tell us about
that.
It.
Good morning, chairs, members of the committee. My name is Colette Young. I manage acute and communicable disease prevention for the Oregon Health Authority, and I'm here to request permission to apply for a competitive federal grant to support syndromic surveillance in Oregon. So you're right. Syndromic surveillance is monitoring all emergency department visits across the state to look for trends in chief complaint, symptoms, and other issues that might suggest public health emerging issues that we can quickly respond to and then work with our hospital partners to get help. This grant in particular helps us with partnerships. It will allow us to exercise and plan with local health departments, train them on how to use Essence. It will allow us to work with hospitals and hospital and healthcare systems to train them in how to use Essence for quality improvement. And then it will allow us to work with Washington State, also an Essence user, to plan some regional trainings and exercise. We will also then give a small portion of data to the National Syndromic Surveillance System, and that will allow the CDC then to monitor at an aggregate level what's happening in the country. We would like to apply for $400,000 a year over 4 years, and this would be limited duration positions. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
I have one question, because I understand that it's the monitoring of like flus and disease outbreaks or whatever, but how does wildfires and large gatherings fit within this category in surveillance?
Thank you, Senator Winters, chairs, members of the committee. It is an excellent tool, actually, for natural hazards, because when we have one down the pike, let's say Central Oregon wildfires that we're seeing a lot of, we can look at the regional hospitals and monitor who's coming in for respiratory illness, who's coming in for increased chronic heart disease issues, who's coming in for traffic accidents and other injury that can be related to the wildfire. And we will give you and public health a much better picture of what's actually going on and what the true costs are of those hazards. We also will then help the hospitals inform their planning, their staffing, their triage, so that they can be more efficient in their work.
Two quick questions from me. One, how much of a burden is it for the emergency rooms to report? They're reporting a lot of data all the time to different agencies and places. Is this something you just pick out of their electronic database, so they don't have to do much of anything? And if I were to ask them, would they give me the same answer?
Thank you. Yes, they should. this is an automated system. We're already up and running in all the states, or all the emergency departments across the states. So it's fully automated. There's no button pushing on their side. We get a feed once a day, and so it's near real time. And it's automated for us to, it then runs it through a series of questions and algorithms and looks for patterns in the symptoms that are, that they present with.
Kind of amazing. I never heard of it. And the last thing is these are limited duration positions. And so when those go away, can you still maintain the system? Is this just for getting it up and running, or are you in a situation where 3 or 4 years, if you get the grant, that you're going to have to make these permanent positions? What's the story?
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. They will go away. We have a very small staff working on Essence. It's about 0.8 FTE. She manages it along with the state data center, and that is ongoing work. This work is specific to building improvements, quality improvements, and then also a training capacity so that we can carry that on, but we won't have the, we'll have the bulk of the work done.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. Questions from the committee?
This is a good thing.
I'm sorry, what?
This is a good thing, that's all.
Okay. I would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, I recommend the LFO recommendation, which is approval of the request to apply for a grant to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in the amount of up to $400,000 a year for 4 years to enhance syndromic surveillance.
We have before us a motion to approve this grant. Any objections? Seeing none, so moved. Does that fit a full ways and means? Okay, we need a carrier for that then. Would you mind?
I'm happy to.
Representative Nathan's fine.
What if a physician carries it?
It's fine. Whoever wants to handle syndromic surveillance is.
I'll take syndromic surveillance, so I'm good with that.
Senator Stanner Hayward will do it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative. Thanks for
Thank you, Chair.
Sort of educating me. I never didn't know this was going on.
Mr. Chair, yes. It's refreshing to hear something like this for electronic surveillance rather than listening to drones or privacy issues, you know, in the judiciary.
So. Thank you for that perspective. I'll be right on. Thank you for your testimony this morning, and good luck in getting that grant.
Thank you.
We're going to open up public hearing now on...
close that one.
Thank you. We're going to close the work session and open a public hearing on the Oregon Health Authority, Addiction Mental Health, and the Oregon State Hospital. This is Senate Bill 5526. Please introduce yourselves to the committee and for the record, and we are happy to hear from you.
Good morning. For the record, I'm Greg Roberts, the superintendent at Oregon State Hospital.
Good morning, Chairs Bates, Nathanson, committee members. My name is John Swanson. I'm the chief financial officer at the Oregon State Hospital.
And for the record, I'm Kate Nass with Department of Administrative Services.
Thank you. Chairs Nathanson and Bates and members of the committee, I thought it would be appropriate last time we were here before the committee, Representative Nathanson had said, could we come back tomorrow? And I said, well, I wish I could, but we had the Joint Commission suddenly appear on our doorstep, and we had a five-day survey that went, I'm very happy to tell you, went extremely well. You have a report in front of you, and I can tell you honestly, I've worked 42 years in the field of mental health, all in state institutions, all of which applied for and or received Joint Commission accreditation, and I've never had experience a better survey outcome than we experienced a few weeks ago. The surveyors were totally impressed with the hospital, not only the physical facility, but with the care and treatment being provided in the hospital, with our performance improvement systems. I took down quotes from them only because they were so remarkable. They told us that we are wonderful, exceptional, brilliant, phenomenal, amazingly good shape. They encouraged us to post several of the things we do on the Joint Commission's Best Practices website so it can be shared around the country, and even encouraged us to apply for the Baldrige Award, which we are looking into doing. So quite amazing transformation of the hospital, we think, in a five-year period. So we certainly couldn't have had that conversation 5 or 6 years ago.
Congratulations. I'll just warn you a little bit. I think we have one of the best systems in other areas of the state, and commonly the Attorney General of the United States comes in and sues us just for that reason alone, so watch out. No good deed ever goes unpunished. But thank you for doing a great job. Mm-hmm. It has been night and day changes, and we appreciate it. And for those of us who have gone through Joint Commission accreditation, it is a grueling, heartless thing you go through, and to get a good report is great. How many years do you have now?
The Senator raised 3 years.
Gave you the usual 3 years.
Yes.
Were there any comments about how you compared to other state hospitals around the nation?
Senator Bates again and members of the committee. Just generally speaking, we asked about some comparisons, and these were the words they used. They told us we're far ahead of the curve. They were especially impressed with our performance improvement, lean methodology systems, and saw that it had worked its way down to the patient unit level, which they actually said they have not seen even in private hospital corporations, as well as we're doing it in the state hospital.
Congratulations. So, Senator Starner Haywood.
Just to reinforce two things, JACO is notoriously picky. I mean, notoriously, dare I use the polite term hard-tailed, you can interpret for the one that I can't say on record. And so I would just echo Senator Bates' commendations, and also that they actually encouraged you to apply for the Baldrige Award. Mm. That speaks volumes. I mean, that award is... I don't think there's a hospital in Oregon that's won this award. I don't even know if there's a hospital that's applied for it before, and that they're encouraging you to do that. Pretty darn good. Congratulations.
Chairs Nathanson and Bates and Senator Hayward, we've checked. There's actually no state hospital in the country that's a recipient of the Baldrige Award. So if we're successful with that, that's...
I hope you're going for it.
Yes, we are.
Good.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
Good.
Senator, Representative Olson.
I just was looking online what Malcolm Baldrige Award is all about, and pretty good.
Yeah.
Didn't know that.
Yeah. So, keep you posted.
Senator Whitaker.
Just a quick question, whether or not I asked the question of the comparison with other states, whether or not that the committee actually posts, after their findings about other states. You know, we constantly talk about, transparency and what's occurring. Do you know whether that exists or not?
Chairs Bates and Nathanson and Senator Winters, members of the committee, the Joint Commission does post the findings. These are our final. This is our final report. Initially, it's a preliminary report. We've gotten our final report pretty quickly, so it is posted on there. Website. I don't know that they do an actual comparison. You'd probably have to go through the different reports of the different states and other hospitals to compare. One thing I should mention, it's related to our performance improvement process. We have 13 or 14 separate, what we call functional work groups, where we divide the standards of the Joint Commission into, so each group is responsible for a certain category of the standards. And we are constantly reviewing our compliance with the standards. So it's our motto is actually to be survey ready every day, because in the past, Joint Commission surveys used to be announced in advance, so you knew when they were coming and you could prepare. And these days, both Joint Commission and CMS show up unannounced, so you have to be ready every day for a survey. So that's what we aspire to be. And that said, and I know from conversations with Senator Winters in the past, we won't rest on our laurels. We know of some less than full compliant areas that the surveyors didn't necessarily notice. So we're aware of those. We're working on those. And the standards change all the time. Every year, standards are upgraded and challenge you further. So we won't be sitting on our laurels here and saying we're fine. We still have lots of improvements we want to make. So.
Again, congratulations.
Thank you. And we'll send you, if you haven't received something in writing already, we're celebrating this achievement, but also the end of the transition process of the hospital. We've opened our Junction City facility on March 11th. We've now closed our Portland facility on March 31st. So to celebrate that across the hospital, we have an event planned for May 8th, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. If you can make it, we'd love to have you there as part of the celebration. So we'll send you something. So then to the PowerPoint slide, we wanted to begin with a topic we talked about extensively at the first appearance about our 370 population. These are people who come to the hospital to be restored to the ability to aid and assist. And in the month of March, was significantly problematic for us. The census has jumped from about 151 to now above 170. We had a net gain of 17 370s in the hospital in the month of March. And the trend line on the slide you're looking at tells you if this continues, and there are some legislative proposals that we'll talk about in a minute to try to stem the tide, but you can see that the five-year trend has been steadily up. The increase we've seen in March, if it continues, projects out to be more, almost 200 370 patients in the hospital.
Just a quick question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. Is there one particular part of the state that you're getting more of than the other part of the state?
Good question.
Chairs Nathanson and Bates and Senator Winters, members of the committee, we have that data to give you. I have it broken out by county. It's fairly widespread. It's not, we can't point to one or two particular counties that are responsible for the increase.
So, well, yeah. I know the fault, but you don't.
I was trying to think of any policy that we did that would have changed that actually resulted in this increase.
Chairs Nathanson and Bates, Senator Winters, members of the committee. Not that I'm aware. In fact, I mentioned last time I was here that I'm Irish, so I'm automatically superstitious. It makes me nervous, actually, to talk about the 370 issue in public because it seems like every time we do, our numbers increase. The issue for us, as we talked about last time, is the felony and misdemeanors, is where some proposals have been made about the statutory changes. The next slide gives you the month of March breakdown, where we've seen the net increase of 17. This is the breakout of charges. And we asked our treatment teams to express the opinion, having met the patient, evaluated the patient, how many do we think actually required a hospital level of care? And there were 8 patients identified as people who our treatment teams think could have been treated in the community if community services had been available to them. So people are coming to the hospital having been arrested for a low-level charge and then taking up a bed as a 370 patient in the hospital.
So let me ask the opposite question from Senator Winters. First, I'd like to see a breakdown of where the patients are coming from versus the population of the county they're coming from. Not just what county they're coming from, what that population of the county is and how many are coming from that county.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking for the opposite. I believe that what we're going to see, and I'm just the testimony we've taken here and in public safety, that you might see places like Marion County having a very low admission because of the programs they put in place, and other counties having a higher admission rate. But if you can break it down by county per population, per 10,000 people, probably is probably the number you'd use. We use 100,000 in medical situations, but for this, it's probably per 10,000. And really see if we have some anomalies. I have a terrible feeling that we may see a situation where some counties are sort of sweeping the streets and sending people up. Second question is, how long do they stay? What's the average length of stay for people in this situation? And thirdly, when we have a problem in medicine, we look for, you know, in a system, we look for something called root cause analysis. I mean, something's going on here.
Right.
In the last 7 years, we've gone from 80 or 90 patients in to almost 200. And this is too expensive, wrong place. Something's going on. And we need to look at this and find out what it is, because we can't work with a problem until we understand the problem. So I'd really like to have those questions answered and brought back to us, if you would, please. This just can't be allowed to continue. My guess is a lot of these people could have been diverted to their communities, dealt with there, and had a potentially a better outcome. I'm just guessing, but I don't know for sure. And I'm Irish, too, and I have the same problem. I try to be scientific, but, you know, let's bring it up.
Chairs Nathanson and Bates and members of the committee, in the from our first appearance, there was a chart, which we can work in detail for you, where we had the leading counties of and rates per 100,000. Population. So we can update that. This chart was through December 31st. We can update that
for you
and provide the additional information.
Senator
Thank
Winters.
You. The other number four is whether or not the individual had a public defender or what was the legal support. That tends to actually determines whether or not they're getting into your facility or not. So that's another piece of the puzzle that would be nice if we had that information.
Okay. Chairs Nathanson and Bates and Senator Winters, we attempted to get, that was a question you raised in the first session, and we're unable, we do not keep track of that. So our legal affairs department is attempting to see if they can come up with that data, but right now we don't have that that data broken out. The phenomenon is, this is a nationwide phenomenon. It's generally referred to as the criminalization of the mentally ill, and I think what it represents is that people with mental illness in the community who are problematic somehow in their community, but who are not, they do not meet the involuntary commitment standard of dangerous. So they may be, for example, as we said, urinating in public, sleeping on a park bench, arguing with a policeman, making noise in their neighborhood. They're problematic and they're clearly mentally ill, but they're not so dangerous as to be involuntarily committable. And this, what we see here and across the country, is the outcome of that. So that in order to get people into the treatment that they pretty clearly need, they get arrested for something and then move into the system that way. So the thing I always like to stress personally is on one level we can be talking about community-based restoration services, but that assumes in the first place that the person was arrested and therefore needs to be restored to the ability to aid and assist their attorney. What we've focused on, and the Marion County experience where we worked with excellent work group, is to not arrest people in the first place, to find a way to get them into the services they require without being arrested. And to the extent that community services are available, I think the Marion County experience has shown that's very doable. So people are not in jail, they're not in the state hospital, but they're receiving treatment in the community.
Then one would think that perhaps we need to explore those possibilities of replicating what we're doing in Marion County.
Representative Nathanson, Senator Bates, members of the committee, and Senator Winters, I absolutely agree.
First, I want to congratulate Marion County for the work they're doing. We've been looking at it pretty carefully through Senator Winters. She's led us to the programs they're doing here. I'd like to see statistically if they are doing what we think they're doing. They probably are. Have these people come through mental health courts before coming to state hospital?
Chairs Bates and Nathanson and members of the committee, I don't believe so. I think there's great variation across the state in terms of how mental health courts approach their work, and I'm told that for the most part they'll deal with people who are outpatient and not so much people coming in to the system as people who have been in the system. So, but and there's no I'm told when you've seen one mental health court in Oregon, you've seen one mental health court. There's not a standard approach to the work.
Well, that's something we may need to look at. Mm-hmm. I mean, these costs are horrible, and this isn't the way to treat these people. We know under state law that we can require people on an outpatient basis while they're under the jurisdiction of the courts to take their medications, stay in housing, and be taken care of. And if they don't, then they can be placed in the state hospital. But that is not being applied uniformly across the state, obviously, and it's something we probably need to do. We also have to have the outpatient services everywhere in the state for that to occur. And it sounds to me like these kind of costs, avoidance of these costs, would easily take care of the cost of setting up mental health courts.
Right.
And they probably could be, as they have in some places, combined with drug and alcohol and mental health in the same court setting and start dealing with these issues up front and not in the state hospital. Have you had discussions about that at all? About you should receive these people, and there's no. Here we are today. What is the plan here?
Senator Bates, Representative Nathanson, members of the committee. The part of the plan is in the legislative concepts that have been proposed in terms of. I don't have the bill number. It may be on an upcoming slide. To at least have the court that is referring the person to the state hospitals at 370 would be required to connect to the mental health system in the county to determine whether the person can be served in the community. Right now, there isn't necessarily that conversation that takes place when the person's appearing in court. So that would be some progress to at least determine whether the person could access community treatment. But in the absence of expanding community treatment, I think the answer would often be that the services don't exist in the community to serve that person.
Of course, if we include in that bill that we'll charge them the cost of that patient in the hospital on a daily basis, I think things would change pretty quickly.
Senator Bates, you may be correct.
Thank you.
Right.
Senator Winters.
This is an issue that we actually looked at in doing some of the work with 3194 in the subcommittee, not only on mental health courts, but also on drug courts and some of the, what we're finding, there is the inconsistency across the state. Some have mental health courts, some do not. One of the things at CJC we recommended that they actually do a mapping across the state to begin to look at what is. So that we can, and then what standards or best practices exist, so that we can begin to look at across the state of what we need to do with respect to not only drug courts but mental health courts, because what we have currently is a patchwork of a little bit of everything. Some courts have, you know, multiple features inside. No one actually, with the exception of perhaps drug courts, actually have anywhere that looks to best practices or what have you. And it's, I think that we need to actually begin to sit down with DHS, and I've said this before, the Oregon Health Authority and the correctional piece, and begin a broad mapping to identify what's in what we have currently and what we need in order to go forward in the future.
Thank you. I think you're absolutely right. AMH is doing that mapping right now as far as what's available for treatment. But I don't know if there's a mapping going on the other side, which is in the court system, of what's available and what needs to be available.
Right.
So
they need to come together, because we're operating in isolation, and I think the two need to be brought together so that we're working jointly on this issue.
But the courts have to understand they have to have skin in the game in this. As long as they can do this and dump these patients in the state hospital and have no responsibility for what happened financially, I think they're going to keep doing it. Mm-hmm. There's no reason for them not to do it other than it's the wrong thing to do. So I think we have to have a broader conversation here, and I appreciate that we're looking at this and thinking about it. Any questions? It is a huge problem, and a lot of money is involved here. So let's all be thinking about it.
I think it was Saxon Westheimer.
commenter.
Could you identify yourself for the record?
Lynn Saxton, Director of the Oregon Health Authority, Chair Bates, co-chairs Bates and Nathanson. I just wanted to bring into this discussion the fact that the Oregon Supreme Court, led by Chief Justice Ballmer, has initiated a look at this at the court level. For the juvenile mental health system, which of course goes through 18. So part of the problem or part of the issue is being addressed, and they will have a report that will supplement our mapping of the mental health system.
Thank you.
So to continue just a bit further with the 370 problem, the increase, the sudden and significant increase in 370 referrals is problematic, especially from the point of view that we have 6 or 7 units at the state hospital reserved for 370 patients, 158 beds. But our census recently has been above 170. And because the law requires us to admit a 370 patient within 7 days of the court order being signed, we then have been forced to place 370 patients into units that are not designed to serve 370 patients. So about 12 or 13 370 patients are now housed on units that are designed to serve guilty except for insanity patients, and this week we'll be placing 7 or 8 370 patients onto the units that are designed to serve civilly committed people. So it begins to be a population mix that's also undesirable because the treatment needs are different. And in fact, in the past week or two, we have exceeded the 7-day legal requirement pretty routinely. Some patients have actually stretched out to 13 or 14 days before we've been able to admit them. So it has become a pretty significant problem. Very, very suddenly, that spike is a real challenge for us. And because, you know, the ball keeps bouncing, to the extent that we have to put 370 patients into beds that are reserved for civilly committed people, then people who are on the civil commitment wait list have to wait longer to be admitted, and that backs up the inpatient unit system and eventually people into emergency rooms with the psychiatric boarding problem. So in terms, I agree with Senator Bates, in terms of a root cause, the root cause there is the 370 issue, and especially the misdemeanor 370 issue that we've been talking about.
Let me ask a couple of questions, if I could, just on a financial basis. I did some quick calculations. We have roughly 100 more people in the hospital on a daily census for this. And I know people are rolling in and out. Let's say that's where you're at. You got 100 extra people in the hospital because of this. It's about $300,000 a year per person to be in the hospital, if I'm correct. And I did the math real quickly. It looks like about $60 million in a biennium is being spent of this population, a lot of which could be avoided. That's $60 million. We can open up drug courts for that real easy. Okay, and this is crazy. Then, of course, the question becomes, if you have such a huge backlog on civil admits that you'd fill those beds anyway, or are we looking at something that somewhere in here we can actually have less people in the hospital on either civil commits or 370s that would actually save that kind of money, and we could move that money into a better system, community health, community mental health, community drug and alcohol, and into a court system that says before you go to the state hospital, you got to go through our court. We have standards across the state that are the same or close to, and we're going to put you in a court jurisdiction, so you got that stick to make sure you do the right thing, and the carrot is you don't go to the state hospital, you stay in your community to get treated. And we looked at that sort of big picture about this thing. I mean, how does this allow to happen over 3 or 4 years if not anybody screaming bloody murder about $60 million? And if my math's wrong, and I'm off by a factor of 10, tell me, but that's the number I've got. Am I even close?
Chairs Nathanson and Bates, a high percentage of the people who are 370 patients are, we feel, appropriate for state hospital level. They have felony charges and misdemeanor charges. So it's the misdemeanor population. So we'd have to look at the number of people who are in the hospital on the misdemeanor charges and then do the math from there. So I'm not arguing that no 370 people should ever come to the state hospital, but there is some percentage of people in March, as we said, it was 8 out of 56 in 1 month who we felt could have been treated in the community if the services had been there. So.
But in 4 years, it's doubled. In 4 years, it's doubled. That means you either weren't treating people before you should have, or somebody's sweeping the streets out there.
Dr. Bates.
And we're talking $60 million, plus or minus. Yes, sir.
Yeah, no, I hear what you're saying. I agree with what you're saying. Yesterday, I met with a couple DAs, kind of trying to pattern off of what Marion County has done with 416, but moving and shifting it toward the mental health side of things. And what I really appreciated about the conversation I had with the DAs, a couple of the directors from the mental health, county mental health folks, and sheriffs, is that the DAs are interested in trying to catch all this at the front end rather than having to do this at the back door issue. And you know what? Especially when we're talking about the misdemeanors, if they can have people, crisis, you know, response folks respond to a situation of mental health at the front end, deal with it, and get it directed appropriately, it saves down the long run. You get it from having to all of a sudden see the court, seeing where the DA has to all of a sudden get involved. And I think that that's where a lot of your savings is going to be. But, boy, I hear you with the $60
million. It just reinforced that we need to have this conversation and work with the correctional side as well, because not only are we talking about the cost with the Oregon State Hospital, those costs, but it's also the jail costs. So there's some, you know, the front end, which I think we would all like to be able to occur. I just think we need to really bring the disciplines together to begin to work on this particular issue.
And to a certain, I couldn't agree more. And to a certain degree, we're beating up on the messenger. You don't really have control of this. You have to accept right. them, and I appreciate that. Mm-hmm. But what you've done is appropriately tell us, hey, wake up, legislature. We got a real problem here. You better get on it. Okay?
Chair Nathan Bates, I don't feel the least bit beat up. And okay. you know, it's a problem that's been growing. We have been talking about it for a few years. And it just, as I said, after a while, you start to think the more we talk about it, the worse it seems to get. So,
yeah, I understand that part. Yeah. Somebody out there is saying, oh, that's county's doing it. We can do it, too.
Right.
Let's reverse that and say Marion County's doing it right. We can do it, too, instead. So I'll get off my soapbox, leave you alone, but we're going to keep talking about this, and we're going to start working on this problem.
Right. So the next slide was just related to something I was talking about, the decision that we must accept people within 7 days of the order. We started to exceed that. On average, people in March were waiting almost 9 days. And because we're forced to admit people quickly, we don't have a choice to not admit these people. We are taking the steps that are outlined there to deal with the pressure at the front door. But each of those has other consequences, as I said. Then the legislative issues related to this, the arrows that you see downward and upward for HB 2420 and HB 2382, things are moving in opposite directions. House Bill 2420 is what we spoke about earlier, where requires the judge to consult with community mental health programs to determine if restoration services can be provided in the community. That would have the effect of decreasing 370 admissions to the hospital. But House Bill 2382, which adds probation violators to the 370 statute, would have the effect of increasing the number of people coming in to the state hospital. So we're simultaneously moving in both directions. So. Other legislative concepts, House Bill 3347 would expand the criteria for involuntary civil commitment to include the gravely disabled. That would have the potential to increase the census at the state hospital with involuntarily civilly committed people. But one thing I'd like to point out there as part of the discussion, and I've had this discussion with Representative Hoyle, we shouldn't assume that if the statute was changed to include the gravely disabled, we shouldn't assume that that means every gravely disabled person would have to come to the state hospital for treatment. I think there's a good likelihood if community services were in place and expanded, people could be treated in the community. But that conversation tends to have a tone to it that says all the gravely disabled people would go to the state hospital, and I don't think that's a good assumption. House Bill 3502 talks about admitting people to the state hospital after they've been in inpatient treatment for 7 days. And again, that would depend on bed availability in the state hospital. And the general effect of that, as we evaluate it, would be to increase the census at the state hospital as well. But it is related to the psychiatric boarding issue. People who are waiting in emergency rooms to get into inpatient units are looking for a bed that would involve a transfer of a person from the inpatient unit to the state hospital. So, in terms of options that we're looking at, if the context of this is if the 370 population continues to increase, our first option would be to open our fourth unit in the Junction City Hospital. The governor's budget recommended budget does include the funding for that $9.9 million for 24 months. We do not place 370 patients in the Junction City facility. I think Representative Stark asked about that at the last hearing. Because of the expertise that's required to do the forensic evaluations and court testimony, we want to keep all of our 370s in Salem. So if the 370 population continues to grow in Salem, the fourth unit that would open in Junction City would be guilty except for insanity patients. We would transfer one of our units from Salem down to Junction City and then have an additional unit in Salem for the 370 population. And then beyond that, if the trend continued to increase with the 370 population, we do have one vacant unit in the Salem Hospital, and we would have to open that unit for 370 patients as well. If we did that for the second year of the biennium, it would be a $4.6 million cost, which is not in our budget. I mean, that would require some additional funding. But this again, the context is if the trend line continues to go as it's gone, these would be the actions we'd have to come back and talk about. The note on that page relates to the fact, as we've said, the net effect of this, the more we have to admit 370 patients, the fewer beds we have for civilly committed people. That means civilly committed people would wait longer in the inpatient units at a cost of about $800 per day. So it's each thing causes something else that causes a different problem. So, all right, so the next topic is related to discussion from the first hearing about our affiliation or partnership with OHSU. We have several contracts with OHSU, but the one under discussion is the affiliation under which we hire psychiatrists for the state hospital. The context of this for me is that this is a significant factor in the improvements that we've been talking about in the state hospital, to have the number of psychiatrists that we have, some of which come from OHSU, others come from our state employees. We have significantly not only increased over the last 5 years the number of doctors, psychiatrists we have at the state hospital, we've significantly improved the credentials, the quality of the doctors who are working at the hospital. We have now 10 forensically board certified psychiatrists at the hospital. Seven of them come from OHSU. Three are state employees. The contract with OHSU helps us recruit and retain board certified psychiatrists, while the rest of the nation has experienced significant shortages and problems recruiting psychiatrists. We have done pretty well the last 5 years recruiting and retaining the state employed doctors as well as OHSU doctors. The affiliation helps us attract doctors who wish to have an academic affiliation So some of the doctors we employ through the OHSU affiliation teach at OHSU. They supervise students at the hospital, medical students, residents, forensic fellows, and now physician assistants as well.
Senator Steinway.
Yes.
Thank you. Mr. Roberts, could you clarify about the compensation and how that works? I ask this because as an OHSU physician where there's a lot of people in family medicine who work part-time for the state and part-time for OHSU, essentially in those cases, most of the time, the state buys a portion of their time from OHSU. Are you paying, what percentage of their time are they spending at the hospital? What percentage are they spending directly at OHSU? Do you have medical students who come down and work with them at the state hospital? Could you clarify that arrangement a little bit for us, please?
Sure. Chairs Nathan Senator Bates and Senator Steiner Hayward, members of the committee. It's the next slide.
Okay,
so
perfect.
We'll get to that in a second, but
great. Thank you.
We have that information.
Didn't mean to jump the gun. I apologize.
Should
have read ahead.
That's okay. Again, the benefits, we have continuing education opportunities for all OSH doctors through OHSU, Grand Rounds programs, and some others that take place, access to medical students, as I said. It gives us a highly qualified group of professionals to care for a complicated forensic population, and especially the more and more the population of the state hospital is becoming a forensic population. The improved quality of the forensic evaluations and testimony at PSRB hearings have surely, no doubt about it, resulted in the steady decrease of guilty except for insanity patients at the state hospital. So as we talked about in our first appearance, the guilty except for insanity line has gone steadily down while the 370 population has gone steadily up.
So Mr. Roberts, that change that we made is working.
Senator Rich is absolutely. Yeah, Senate Bill 420 is what you're referring to.
Senator Steiner.
So just to clarify, when you see the number of or the length of stay for the GEI patients is decreasing. Could you talk a little bit about what happens with those patients afterwards and what kinds of things are working to help decrease their length of stay?
Chairs Nathan Senator Bates, Senator Steiner Hayward, members of the committee. Absolutely. What this enables us to do with more forensically trained, board-certified psychiatrists, the evaluations that the doctors and the treatment teams do in preparation for a PSRB hearing gives us much better credibility than I would say 5 years ago. The testimony to the PSRB and to the State Hospital Review Panel is just a solid forensic evaluation. So the recommendations when the doctor, the team recommends that the person is ready to leave the hospital, in combination with the fact that PSRB now operates an expanded system of care in the community. They've opened up additional beds in the past few years, so there's more opportunity for people to move out of the hospital into the community, and that decreases the length of stay and the number of patients in the hospital. So we did, response to a question I think Senator Bates asked at the first appearance, the number of people who have reoffended, who have been discharged to the community is quite low. I think it's in a package of information that we provided to you. It's in the single digits. The crimes that those people have committed in the community are, some are serious, I think weapons possession and things like that, but generally not serious crimes. So, between what's called conditional releases, people go to the state, they leave the state hospital and go to a secure facility in the community initially, and then the PSRB continues to have jurisdiction over them in the community and move them to less restrictive settings over time. So it's, I think, as Senator Winters said, I think the work that's been done the past 4 or 5 years have created that network of services in the community that enable people who are guilty except for insanity to leave the state hospital when they're ready to leave, and without creating a significant public death safety problem.
Thank you.
So the I think that's pretty much what I wanted to talk about on that particular slide. But overall, the in in the 21st century, especially in the world we live in, psychiatrists are generally very difficult to recruit and retain. They have lots of opportunities for other work, and we're happy that they choose to work in our hospital. We think it is related, as we talked about the Joint Commission before. Oregon State Hospital is, I wouldn't even say slowly but surely, but surely. Becoming recognized as a really excellent facility. You know, if we imagine if we were to be able to say the Baldrige Award-winning Oregon State Hospital, we have our doctors are publishing in professional journals. They've been appearing at national conferences speaking, and our name is on. We're on the map. Our name is on the lips of people who are involved in this kind of work across the country. So very much like to preserve the ability to recruit physicians as state employees. That's one option. Through an OHSU affiliation is another option. And because the last option, to the extent that we have vacancies we can't fill, we hire people through what's called a locum tenens contract. This is on the next slide. Locum tenens doctors, these are people like agency staff. You call a company that sends doctors who are willing to work temporarily in a particular place. Locum tenens doctors are much more expensive than state employed or OHSU affiliated doctors. So on this next slide, related to Senator Steiner Hayward's question, these are the costs that derive from the OHSU contract, and we're comparing it to state-employed staff. The supervising physicians, these are supervising psychiatrists, they generally carry a caseload that's half of a norm of other doctors. Workload, and they supervise the physicians in a particular area of the hospital. This OHSU supervising doctors are more expensive by $12,000 compared to a state supervising physician. We have three of each, by the way, three OHSU supervising physicians, three state employed. For physicians, non-supervising physicians, the state employed doctors are slightly more expensive by about $8,600 when you take into account salary, benefits, and other costs. So,
Mr. Chair?
Yeah. Yes, I am Chair.
Madam Chair?
Chair.
Thank you. Whoever, I couldn't quite tell who the gavel had moved back. I apologize,
she
Madam Chair. It was a depth perception problem. I apologize. So just to clarify, we're talking about for one supervised, one regular physician, let's just say, we're talking on average $320,000 for salary and OPE, other benefits.
That's correct.
For two years.
No, it says annual.
It's an annual cost.
If you get these guys for 2 years, you're doing really well at that price.
I was going to say, because I think I'm going to go back and retrain as a psychiatrist, because that's way the heck more than I make as a family physician at OHSU. Way the heck more.
Chairs Nathanson and Bates and Senator Steinberg Hayward and members of the committee, hold on to the arms of your chair.
Uh-oh.
One of our psychiatrists just left us for a position that gave her a $15,000 per month salary increase.
Wait, what?
$15,000 per month salary increase to a community
increase.
Provider.
No, I heard that. I heard
right.
That was incredible.
$180,000.
So are you thinking about
that's more
going
than
my
that's okay. No,
a lot of
because
money. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
I mean, now I'm
right.
Not objecting. We need them, and they're good.
Right.
And I know they've got a lot of special training. I'm not objecting,
right.
But I'm a little stunned because I don't know many family physicians who are making anywhere close to that money, and I would argue that
right.
They're kind of important too.
Right. Chairs Nathanson and Bates and Senator Steinberg, that's exactly the point. The competition that we're up against in the world, it looks like that. Psychiatrists are short in number, especially child adolescent psychiatrists are very difficult to find, and they can command these type of salaries. So,
yes, Senator.
House,
I take the house, Mrs.
Thank
Mrs.
You.
Pink.
Thank you. She'll do anything for me on the day I wear her shirt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The OHSU physicians compared to the OSH, my understanding is the OHSU ones work 4 days and the OSH ones work 5 days. Is that correct?
Chairs Nathanson and Bates and Representative Kenny Guy are members of the committee. They work at the OHSU doctors work at the state hospital 4 days. Some work, and the fifth day is what's generally referred to as an OHSU day. Some of them teach at OHSU. Some bring students to the hospital on that day. Others are engaged in research projects that we've approved. And some work actually with the patients. They do their job 5 days a week if necessary. So if the clinical workload requires them to see patients, assess patients, then they work at the hospital. So it's actually it's a 5 day work week, but at least four of those days have to be present at the hospital.
Can you please give us a sense of how often they actually work that fifth day? I know this has been a point of contention.
Right. Chairs Bates and Representative Kenny, Nathanson and Kenny, and Representative Kenny Guyer. We can get you that, yes. We need to keep in mind, to compare apples to apples, some of the state employed physicians also work for 10-hour days. So not all physicians work a 5 day work. So I can give you that comparison.
Mr. Roberts, I think it would be helpful. I know we're looking at the compensation at OHSU and OSH. It might be taking one of our neighboring hospitals and actually give us what those salaries are for clarity, you know, recognizing that, you know, you're having to be competitive nationally as well as what we have in the state. So that might help us as we look at this whole salary area. Senator Bates.
And just a couple of quick questions. Thanks, Madam Chair. Could you also give us, not today but later, what their caseload is on a daily basis? How many patients are actually seeing and interacting with? Are the OHSU physicians residents or board-certified psychiatrists?
Chairs Nathanson and Bates and members of the committee, they're not students. They are they're board certified psychiatrists. Okay. Additionally, we have forensic fellows and residents come, but we don't pay for those. No.
And I'll just comment that if I could, everyone in primary care would like to go back and do a different residency. We never realized the difference in situations here. And I would tell you also, orthopedists, ophthalmologists, others, we can double this number,
and
easily
surgeons.
Double this number. Wow. And that's the truth out there in healthcare right now, because they're doing things nobody else can do, and there's not enough of them. And it's just a matter of supply and demand, and the demand is huge. And with the cutting off of residencies in this country back in the 90s, the demand is far outstripped what's available, and that's what's driving these up. It's getting a little out of hand, frankly, from my point of view. But that said, I'll leave it there. You have to be competitive. You have to bring these people in. You don't have much choice.
Right.
And it's shocking, because you can see these numbers because you're a public institution. If you went and saw others, you'd be even more surprised.
Chairs Nathanson and Bates, members of the committee, Senator Bates and Senator Steiner Hayward, if you go back to school and become psychiatrists, we'd be happy to employ you.
Yeah,
with permission, Madam Chair, with as little as my husband tolerates me being a legislator, I think he'd tolerate me being a resident again even less.
Yeah.
So,
Madam Chair,
yes.
I might. There's two reasons I wouldn't do that. One, I'm too old. And secondly, I'm not sure I could get out of the hospital once I got in there. I'm a little concerned about that, so I think I'll just stay where I'm at.
Okay. Continue.
I'm happy to say the next slides are Mr. Swanson's.
So. Thanks, Greg. Chairs Bates and Nathanson, committee members. Slide 9 is an opportunity for us to share a little bit about some of the activities that we've started to improve or look at potentially improving other and federal fund revenues at the hospital. As I mentioned in the first discussion, about 86% of the funding for the hospitals, both combined Salem and Junction City, is about 86% of the $493 million budget. The 14% is principally disproportionate share hospital and designated state health program, which is kind of fixed amounts of dollars. The amount of dollars that we collect from actually billing for Medicaid, Medicare, third parties, a small portion is about 4.5%. And so what we've been looking at is to continue our improvements in general for the hospital, as we've just talked about the strides that have been made in improving the clinical aspect of the hospital and the facilities and the operations. We think we're positioned to be able to leverage a fair amount of increase of federal participation now. And we believe that with the last Joint Commission review that we're poised to propose to CMS that we CMS certify additional units at our hospital. Currently, we only have five civil units CMS certified, and about a year, year and a half ago, we really only had one. So the infrastructure and the effort around billing was fairly minimal. And so with that as the opportunity to go out and certify additional units and then have the opportunity to bill and collect for benefits our patients are eligible for, which not only reduces their liability and burden when they leave the hospital, but it generates additional other and federal funds for the hospital to remove or reduce the general fund burden for operation. So we have actively been working since I arrived about a year ago to build up our infrastructure to be able to do that. We've hired quality individuals into our what I call our patient resource services section that had some vacancies and didn't really have the capacity to bill at a much higher rate as we start bringing these additional units onto CMS certification. We also have been working on finalizing our upgrade to our billing system, which is part of the electronic health records program that was put in at the hospital, and we've made great strides on that. We're very close to being able to bill most of our services that are eligible through this system now. The other thing that I've been working on is trying to connect more with our community mental health and Medicaid teams, particularly on a policy level, to make sure that the hospital has a presence when discussions occur around waivers and policy that would affect revenue opportunities. I don't believe in the past the state hospital was a part of those very often. And then, of course, we are also looking at part of the improvements that we've made, which is part of what we are seeing happening anyway, is the documentation of the treatment and services is improving to the place where it would support the ability to bill for more services. So really, that's been the focus, the optimization of the infrastructure, and I think we're getting close to being able to say we're going to be able to handle more opportunities to bill for services. So once we have that, then we will pursue, and we've been discussing timing on this, pursue expanding our CMS certification of units, which will then make more of our patients CMS or Medicaid, Medicare eligible. We're also looking at some of the activities that we're performing at the hospital that are really related to Medicaid enrollment services, which we believe if we structure that correctly, we could potentially receive an administrative match, 50% match on those services. And then we'll be looking at other opportunities. One thing that we've kind of just been talking a little bit about is the potential of adding a inpatient psychiatric service benefit to the CCO coverage that the state manages its Medicaid program through. We did a kind of a survey and found that about half of our patients that come to the hospital are part of a CCO, but when they come to the hospital, there's no benefit from the CCO for services at our hospital.
John, so, have you done a cost-benefit analysis and determined approximately how much that we're talking about in real dollars?
Chairs Bates, Nathanson, and Senator Winters, I've done some estimates, and I'm kind of reluctant to put a lot out there right now because I haven't seen it, but I think that we could move the bar from 86% of general fund maybe somewhere in the phase of 70-75%, or maybe a little less. A lot of I was kind of reluctant to do a lot of research. I know that there's opportunity there, but whenever I had to do research, it was all done manually, and I was pulling my people off to do that. We've done some snapshots of time and found that if everything worked perfectly, we had would have potentially between $10 and $15 million worth of reimbursement if all of those individuals were found to be eligible and we had all the units certified and were able to bill everything, had all the documentation. So I think there's a significant opportunity there. I don't really want to put a number on it yet until I have everything in place. I think we did add $4 million next year into other federal funds in anticipation of some improvement, and I hope to do significantly better than that. But until I have everything in place and we get the CMS certification, and there's a lot of things to be answered yet before we can actually implement some of these things. But they have a lot of opportunity.
Yes, Mr. Roberts.
Sorry. One of the issues that's been, I wouldn't say we're arguing with CMS, but we're debating, is the eligibility of forensic patients for CMS certification. That's been argued in the past, and now that we have the hospital in the condition that we have it, we're coming back to that argument. We believe the statute permits GEI and 370 patients to be living on certified units, and therefore some of the services we provide would be billable for eligible patients. So that would since most of our units are GEI and 370, that would be a significant increase for us.
So I'm not sure I quite understand this, but I want to try to get it because it has ramifications for the larger OHA budget. CMS certification would allow you in some way, shape, or form to partially bill CCOs for the services you render to them. Okay. How would the money flow?
No. The way it could flow, and again, this is very preliminary, is if we're certified, have certified units, and individuals come to our hospital that are a member of a CCO, and there were a benefit in the CCO benefit package that include inpatient psychiatric care, we would negotiate a rate with the CCO, and we would provide a service just like any other hospital. And we would bill for those services, whatever the agreement of the contract were, and collect those dollars. Now, what would have to happen on the OHA side is that their rate, their per member per month rate, would have to be adjusted for that. But those per member per month rates are a match rate or 100% federally funded, whereas our services are 86% generally funded. So just looking at that possibility, we do have some studies that indicate that some states, at least I believe it was Iowa, is actually doing this through a behavioral health organization. This kind of passes from the Medicaid program to the behavioral health organization to the hospital. Right now, the only individuals that we can bill for on Medicaid are those in a certified, CMS-certified civil unit that are under 21 and over 65. And anyone else is excluded because of what's called the Institution for Mental Disease Exclusion. But we believe it's possible, and we're looking at that the process or flow of dollars through the CCO would basically make many more people eligible for that coverage. But again, it's very infant stages right now that we're starting to look at it.
Now, would this require a waiver from CMS?
I believe it. Chairs Bates, Nathans, and Senator Winters, I believe it would. So there's, again, I want to preface this, that this is some opportunities we're looking into. There's a lot of steps that would have to happen to ultimately get to something.
And if I could just add again, I think the context of this, we have to realize this is really because of the improvements that have been made at the hospital. We couldn't have had this conversation 3-4 years ago. But because the hospital, the physical plant has significantly improved therapeutic environment for the patients and provision of active treatment, now we can have this conversation.
Can I state it another way, that it's moved from what CMS and others would talk about, institutional care versus hospital? Mm-hmm. Is that the underlying premise?
Chair Space, Nathanson, Senator Winters, we believe it would make more of our patients considered patients rather than incarcerated.
Right.
We actually now have a special condition that allows us for, to bill for some services, Part B, fee-for-service, for those individuals, because by law we're required to bill for our services and attempt to collect it. By that special condition, it it makes those individuals eligible for Part B. We can't charge the Part A, which is the all-inclusive, the larger dollar rate, for those individuals through Medicaid right now. But if we were able to do the CCO opportunity, it may open up some opportunities for us.
Good. Senator Bates.
Madam Chair, first off, thank you for pursuing this. I think it's very important you do that for lots of reasons. One, with expansion under the ACA of Medicaid, I would expect there's a large number of your patients who are probably Medicaid eligible who are in there. I have no problem with CCOs being responsible for the cost of those patients there because it drives them to do more at the community level. I would guess that CMS might offer this, might agree with your offer if they knew that we had a strong community-based plan and that we're moving people back and forth in a fairly reasonable fashion and getting the right thing done. So I think the overall plan is great. I appreciate that. Backing it up a little bit, though, and I know this is very preliminary, if it looks like that's starting to happen, we're going to have to talk about billing these issues into the rates we pay the CCOs. And that is a huge discussion going on right now, whether it's this, dental rates, rates for hospitals, rate for physicians and other providers. So it gets very complicated as we back it up into the rates that we're going to be paying. But I have no problem with this. Don't get me wrong. I think it's great you're pursuing this. I didn't know you could even do it. I've always been told that once they hit that front door at your institution, that was over with. That obviously is not the case, so I appreciate that. So anything you move towards with a federal share, I think is very appropriate and probably is a result of the fact you've done so well at the hospital. I expect that they've come looked at the old hospital and said, we're not going to pay for this. We are not going to pay for this. But with the new programs, the new hospital, they're probably willing to do that. Well, I'm going to guess, though, they're going to want a strong community base to go with it. They're not going to pay for somebody being there for 6, 7, 8 months. They're moving in and out, getting stabilized, and going back to community. I expect you might have an opportunity here. So thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're quite welcome.
So let me move on. The next category that we talked about a little bit in phase one, we want to come back and share a little bit more on the overtime. And slide 10 is just a reminder of what we looked at. We put this together based on an average per patient because of all the changes in the number of patients and effective overtime to indicate that we have been able to affect some change and reduce our overtimes when you look at it, particularly on a cost per patient. The next slide gives you a context, though, in terms of what this piece of our overall payroll and benefits budget is. So in the governor's budget, there's $11.4 million budgeted for overtime for the biennium, about 3.4% of our total payroll and benefits budget. So it's a fairly small amount, but it's an area that we've really been focusing on because it can get out of control. And we've been trying to bring it down. I think Greg actually started a number of these efforts before I arrived, and then I participated in a few after, so I'd like him to describe that a little bit.
This is just a quick look at how, when we see the reduction in the use of overtime and reliance on overtime at the state hospital, these are the factors that went into it, and we'll talk in a minute about the major factor that's left to address. But we did hire more staff because the hospital back in the 2009 time when the USDOJ was focused on the hospital so significantly, the hospital was short of staff. Mandatory overtime was very significant. Lots of problems. So we did hire more staff. We distributed them properly, because, and that was done through a whole data analysis review of where the staff needed to be in order to affect overtime. A significant development, I think it was in 2011, we created two schedule options. People can work at the state hospital. These are direct care RNs, LPNs, and mental health technicians can choose to work Monday to Friday and have every weekend off, or they can work a three-day work week, which includes Saturday, Sunday, and either Friday or Monday. And that had a tremendous effect on overtime and eliminated mandatory mandatory overtime pretty closely. We created a float pool so that we could assign people as necessary, and that was limited duration and temporary positions. Last year, we reached an agreement with SEIU to streamline the internal transfer process. In a nutshell, what was happening was when a position became vacant, it had to be posted for 7 days. Then people would apply. Then people would have to be interviewed. Then someone was selected. So if they moved from another unit, then that position had to be posted for 7 days and interviewed. So it took forever to actually add a person to the payroll. This streamlined the internal process to things that used to take a month now take an hour, the way the change has been made. We have a daily nurse management meeting to review. We established ratios, again, by collecting data, by looking at the different units and what looked like a reasonable number of staff for each unit to work with. We hold the nurse managers accountable to those ratios every day. They either have to face me or Mr. Swanson, and it tends to keep people living within their ratios. And we're focusing on people who call out using sick time or other time unexpectedly, which is the next slide. And it's the there are two major causes now left for our use of overtime. One is the number of call-outs by staff, unexpected call-outs. The number on the left, the vertical line, that's number of shifts. So you're talking about 2,500 or more, between 2,500 and 3,000 shifts per month related to call-outs of staff. So we're looking to address this now. We're in the contract negotiations with SEIU and AFSCME on this issue to begin to hold people more accountable for excessive use of sick leave.
Mr. Roberts, my favorite subject in the trend of what's occurring in your workers' comp rates and the amount of time that the person is off because of workers' comp injuries. And you can bring it back later, but I'd love to have those trends. That's huge. Right. And whether or not things are getting so much better at the hospital that you don't have injuries anymore.
Chairs Nathan, Senator Bates, Senator Winters will bring that information back. We talked about it a bit in phase one. It's a downward trend, fewer aggressive acts, fewer less seclusion and restraint, and less safe claims worker injuries.
And well, just to, along that line, is the training that was put together by OSP and DA Beglaw and others to talk about the frequent flyers and to try to reduce that, is that going to be an ongoing activity?
Representative Nathanson Bates and Senator Winters, yes, absolutely. And it's been helpful. I think they've been at the hospital twice in this past year to do training for staff. And they also do, the state police actually do some counseling for individual patients who are particularly problematic, and it's had a positive effect.
Thank you.
So. The other factor, and we'll talk about it on the last slide, between call-outs, it's the acuity of the patient, so patients on one-to-one and two-to-one supervision that requires staff often on overtime, so we're looking to affect that as well.
The next slide I thought might be interesting. What I did was I've taken the hours of overtime worked over the last several years and converted them to a full-time equivalent positions. The numbers that you see from the position inventory system from the state doesn't do that. It doesn't show how much additional FTE you have from overtime. I'm a little bit concerned about where we are in the governor's budget. It's very aggressive. We're averaging really more around 115 FTE after we've done the efforts we've put into place to push the hours down. And the governor's budget funds 77. So it is very aggressive, somewhat concerning to me, but just want to make that point. And then we did have a question around.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
We've gone around and around the mulberry bush on this. So there's no increase in FTE for regular full-time staff associated with this. He just wants you to cut the overtime. The governor's budget just assumed that you were going to basically cut your overtime in half.
Senator Bates and Representative Nathanson, Senator Steinhardt-Howard.
Don't worry about it.
Yes.
Who asked the question will do.
The one thing that is helpful is that we've moved the the full staff. There's no more of them, but instead of limited durations, we made them full-time permanent staff. So we should be able to hire and retain those more effectively. No, there's really no other increases in staff related to this. So it is going to be a challenge. The last page will show a lot of other things that we're trying to do to change the way we do business and try to increase the number of patients per staff that we can care for. But those are starting. They're not fully.
Kate Nass with Department of Administrative Services, Senator Bates, Chair Nathanson. The governor's budget did include did increase the overtime hours from current biennium to next biennium. We can get you the exact. So what he's identifying here is the FTE. We did not increase the FTE to adjust for overtime. We did, in the governor's budget, include an increase in overtime hours, knowing that they were under an extreme low level for this biennium, for current biennium. And so we can get you the exact growth. The issue is the payroll system or the position budgeting system does not budget overtime by employee or by position for our state budgeting. So we have to budget that offline on a different line item and have a set dollar amount that grows and is cut given different policy decisions.
I'm going to try to get through. We've got.
I'm just going to say, can I have a meeting with you guys offline about this? Because I remain persistently confused. Thank you. That's all I'm going to ask.
In the interest of time, I'll move through this. Senator Hayward asked about whether it would be more effective to hire more people rather than overtime. And did a little analysis where I took the primary users of the overtime direct care staff. Registered nurse, licensed practical nurse, and mental health technicians. And of that group, about 80% of the overtime is actually in the mental health technician line. We have more of those than any of the other two. And what I did was I took the average pay rate for those individuals and divided it by the number of hours actually on their post, so posting time, and compared that hourly rate to having to fill that post with overtime. And actually, for the mental health technicians, it's about a wash. We have a full-time, fully loaded benefit staff on their, and they're on average on their post about 85% of the time. It's not going to cost us much more to hire someone than to pay the overtime on that category. It's the question of what's the right mix of overtime and position so that you don't know who's going to call out. So if people don't, you have way too many people there. If they do call out, then you can you have some overtime to cover it. Again, I talked about the 53 limited ratio positions to full time. We have about $11.4 million in the governor's budget right now, regardless of FTE or whatever other analysis of that. There's $11.4 million, and we're on track to spend about $17 million right now in overtime at the lower rate of what we've been able to push it down to now. So obviously, we could use more overtime funding. We'll try to push it down even further, but it is a risk. Or the other option, as we talked, is if the price is about the same, look at maybe hiring some additional float pool folks that we could assign when needed and where needed rather than paying the overtime. But again, as I talked about earlier, our focus is not to just always be coming asking for more overtime. We'd like to change the way we do business, be able to work more effectively with our patients and be able to care for more of them for each staff, thereby driving down the number of staff and overtime needed to care for our patients.
Right. So the key point there on this last slide is both things, as we said, we're focused on the overtime. We're looking at the call-outs, which is a major cause. We're also looking at the acuity of our patients, which historically at the state hospital, and this has changed in the past year or two, has always been an issue of we're safer if we have more people. And no one believes that anymore. And it's an issue of competency. It's an issue of training. So we are focused on trauma-informed care training, collaborative problem solving, a number of these things that are listed, which would reduce our overtime by reducing the number of staff we need to work on a particular shift. So if 25 patients are on one-to-one every day, and then somehow that's related to the competency of the staff, the training of the staff, that they have, if we can reduce the number of people requiring one-to-one or two-to-one supervision, then we can reduce our overtime by attacking the acuity issue. So it's all those things. So it's conversion of float pool people to full-time, it's focusing on the call-outs, and it's also looking at ways to reduce how many the number of staff we actually need per shift per day. So.
Miss question. Miss Anderson. Nothing. Good job. Thank you.
You did a good job.
With that, we are
2 minutes.
Yes, we are adjourned.
All right. Thank you. Okay.